The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath by H.P. Lovecraft. Part 3. In about a week, the desiderate ship put in by the Black Whale and Tall Lighthouse, and Carter was glad to see that she was a bark of wholesome men, with painted sides and yellow lateen sails, and a gray captain in silken robes. Her cargo was the fragrant resin of Oryab's inner groves, and the delicate pottery baked by the artists of Baharna, and the strange little figures carved from Ngranix, ancient lava. For this they were paid in the wool of Ulthar, and the iridescent textiles of Hathag, and the ivory that the black men carve across the river in Parg. Carter made arrangements with the captain to go to Baharna, and was told that the voyage would take 10 days. And during his week of waiting, he talked much with that captain of Ngranik, and was told that very few had seen the carven face thereon, but that most travelers are content to learn its legends from old people and lava-gatherers and image-makers in Baharna, and afterwards say in their far homes that they have indeed beheld it. The captain was not even sure that any person now living had beheld that carven face, for the wrong side of Ngranik is very difficult and barren and sinister, and there are rumors of caves near the peak wherein dwell the Night Gaunts. But the captain did not wish to say just what a Night Gaunt might be like, since such cattle are known to haunt most persistently the dreams of those who think too often of them. Then Carter asked that captain about unknown Kadath and the cold waste, and the marvelous sunset city. But of these the good man truly could tell nothing. Carter sailed out of Dailath Lean one early morning when the tide turned, and saw the first rays of sunrise on the thin angular towers of that dismal basalt town. And for 2 days they sailed eastward in sight of green coasts, and saw often the pleasant fishing towns that climbed up steeply with their red roofs and chimney pots, from old dreaming wharves and beaches where nets lay drying. But on the third day they turned sharply south, where the roll of water was stronger, and soon passed from sight of any land. On the fifth day the sailors were nervous, but the captain apologized for their fears, saying that the ship was about to pass over the weedy walls and broken columns of a sunken city too old for memory, and that when the water was clear one could see so many moving shadows in that deep place that simple folk disliked it. He admitted, moreover, that many ships had been lost in that part of the sea, having been hailed when quite close to it, but never seen again. That night the moon was very bright, and one could see a great way down in the water. There was so little wind that the ship could not move much, and the ocean was very calm. Looking over the rail, Carter saw, many fathoms deep, the dome of the great temple, and in front of it an avenue of unnatural sphinxes leading to what was once a public square. Dolphins sported merrily in and out of the ruins, and porpoises reveled clumsily here and there, sometimes coming to the surface and leaping clear out of the sea. As the ship drifted on a little, the floor of the ocean rose in hills, and one could clearly mark the lines of ancient climbing streets and the washed-down walls of myriad little houses. Then the suburbs appeared, and finally a great lone building on a hill, of simpler architecture than the other structures, and in much better repair. It was dark and low, and covered four sides of a square, with a tower at each corner, a paved court in the center, and small, curious round windows all over it. Probably it was of basalt, though weeds draped the greater part. And such was its lonely and impressive place on that far hill, that it may have been a temple or a monastery. Some phosphorescent fish inside it gave the small round windows an aspect of shining, and Carter did not blame the sailors much for their fears. Then, by the watery moonlight, he noticed an odd high monolith in the middle of that central court, and saw that something was tied to it. And when, after getting a telescope from the captain's cabin, he saw that that bound thing was a sailor in the silk robes of Oriab, head downward, and without any eyes, he was glad that a rising breeze soon took the ship ahead to more healthy parts of the sea. The next day, they spoke with a ship with violet sails, bound for Zar, in the land of forgotten dreams, with bulbs of strange-colored lilies for cargo. And on the evening of the 11th day, they came in sight of the Isle of Oriab, with Ngranik rising jagged and snow-crowned in the distance. Oriab is a very great isle, and its port of Baharna, a mighty city. The wharves of Baharna are of porphyry, and the city rises in great stone terraces behind them, having streets of steps that are frequently arched over by buildings and the bridges between buildings. There is a great canal which goes under the whole city in a tunnel with granite gates and leads to the inland lake of Yath, on whose farther shore are the vast clay-brick ruins of a primal city whose name is not remembered. As the ship drew into the harbor at evening, the twin beacons Thawne and Thal gleamed a welcome, and in all the million windows of Baharna's terraces, mellow lights peeped out quietly and gradually, as the stars peep out overhead in the dusk, till that steep and climbing seaport became a glittering constellation hung between the stars of heaven and the reflections of those stars in the still harbor. The captain, after landing, made Carter a guest in his own small house on the shores of Yath, where the rear of the town slopes down to it. And his wife and servants brought strange toothsome foods for the traveler's delight. And in the days after that, Carter asked for rumors and legends of Ngranik in all the taverns and public places where lava-gatherers and image-makers meet, but could find no one who had been up the higher slopes or seen the carven face. Ngranik was a hard mountain with only an accursed valley behind it. And besides, one could never depend on the certainty that night gaunts are altogether fabulous. When the captain sailed back to Dailathleen, Carter took quarters in an ancient tavern opening on an alley of steps in the original part of town, which is built of brick and resembles the ruins of Yath's farther shore. Here he laid his plans for the ascent of Ngranik, and correlated all that he had learned from the lava-gatherers about the roads thither. The keeper of the tavern was a very old man, and had heard so many legends that he was a great help. He even took Carter to an upper room in that ancient house, and showed him a crude picture which a traveler had scratched on the clay wall, in the old days, when men were bolder and less reluctant to visit Ngranik's higher slopes. The old tavern keeper's great-grandfather had heard from his great-grandfather that the traveler who scratched that picture had climbed Ngranik and seen the carven face, here drawing it for others to behold. But Carter had very great doubts, since the large rough features on the wall were hasty and careless, and wholly overshadowed by a crowd of little companion shapes in the worst possible taste, with horns and wings and claws and curling tails. At last, having gained all the information he was likely to gain in the taverns and public places of Baharna, Carter hired a zebra and set out one morning on the road by Yath's shore for those inland parts wherein towers stone-eaten Granik. On his right were rolling hills and pleasant orchards and neat little stone farmhouses. And he was much reminded of those fertile fields that flank the sky. By evening, he was near the nameless ancient ruins on Yath's farther shore. And though old lava-gatherers had warned him not to camp there at night, he tethered his zebra to a curious pillar before a crumbling wall and laid his blanket in a sheltered corner beneath some carvings whose meaning none could decipher. Around him, he wrapped another blanket, for the nights are cold in Oryab. And when, upon waking once, he thought he felt the wings of some insect brushing his face, he covered his head altogether, and slept in peace till roused by the macaw birds in distant resin groves. The sun had just come up over the great slope whereon leagues of primal brick foundations and worn walls and occasional cracked pillars and pedestals stretched down desolate to the shore of Yath, and Carter looked about for his tethered zebra. Great was his dismay to see that docile beast stretched prostrate beside the curious pillar to which it had been tied, and still greater was he vexed on finding that the steed was quite dead, with its blood all sucked away through a singular wound in its throat. His pack had been disturbed, and several shiny knick-knacks taken away, and all round on the dusty soil were great webbed footprints for which he could not in any way account. The legends and warnings of lava-gatherers occurred to him, and he thought of what had brushed his face in the night. Then he shouldered his pack and strode on toward Ngranik, though not without a shiver when he saw close to him, as the highway passed through the ruins, a great gaping arch low in the wall of an old temple, with steps leading down into darkness farther than he could peer. His course now lay uphill through wilder and partly wooded country, and he saw only the huts of charcoal burners and the camp of those who gathered resin from the groves. The whole air was fragrant with balsam, and all the macaw birds sang blithely as they flashed their seven colors in the sun. Near sunset, he came on a new camp of lava-gatherers returning with laden sacks from Ngranik's lower slopes. And here he also camped, listening to the songs and tales of the men, and overhearing what they whispered about a companion they had lost. He had climbed high to reach a mass of fine lava above him, and at nightfall did not return to his fellows. When they looked for him the next day, they found only his turban, nor was there any sign on the crags below that he had fallen. They did not search any more, because the old man among them said it would be of no use. No one ever found what the night gaunts took, though those beasts themselves were so uncertain as to be almost fabulous. Carter asked them if night gaunts sucked blood and liked shiny things and left webbed footprints, but they all shook their heads negatively and seemed frightened at his making such an inquiry. When he saw how taciturn they had become, he asked them no more, but went to sleep in his blanket. The next day, he rose with the lava-gatherers and exchanged farewells as they rode west and he rode east, on a zebra he bought of them. Their older men gave him blessings and warnings, and told him he had better not climb too high on Granik. But while he thanked them heartily, he was in no wise dissuaded. For still did he feel that he must find the gods on unknown Kadath, and win from them a way to that haunting and marvelous city in the sunset. By noon, after a long uphill ride, he came upon some abandoned bricked villages of the hill people who had once dwelt thus close to Ngranik, and carved images from its smooth lava. Here they had dwelt till the days of the old tavern keeper's grandfather, but about that time they felt that their presence was disliked. Their homes had crept even up the mountain slope, and the higher they built, the more people they would miss when the sun rose. At last they decided it would be better to leave altogether, since things were sometimes glimpsed in the darkness which no one could interpret favorably. So, in the end, all of them went down to the sea and dwelt in Baharna, inhabiting a very old quarter, and teaching their sons the old art of image-making, which to this day they carry on. It was from these children of the exiled hill people that Carter had heard the best tales about Ngranik when searching through Baharna's ancient taverns. All this time, the great gaunt side of Ngranik was looming up higher and higher as Carter approached it. There were sparse trees on the lower slopes, and feeble shrubs above them. And then the bare, hideous rock rose spectral into the sky, to mix with frost and ice and eternal snow. Carter could see the rifts and ruggedness of that somber stone, and did not welcome the prospect of climbing it. In places, there were solid streams of lava, and scoriac heaps that littered slopes and ledges. 90 eons ago, before even the gods had danced upon its pointed peak, that mountain had spoken with fire and roared with the voices of the inner thunders. Now it towered, all silent and sinister, bearing on the hidden side that secret Titan image whereof rumor told. And there were caves in that mountain, which might be empty and alone with elder darkness, or might, if legend spoke truly, hold horrors of a form not to be surmised. The ground sloped upward to the foot of Ngranik, thinly covered with scrub oaks and ash trees, and strewn with bits of rock, lava, and ancient cinder. There were the charred embers of many camps where the lava-gatherers were wont to stop, and several rude altars which they had built, either to propitiate the great ones, or to ward off what they dreamed of in Ngranik's high passes and labyrinthine caves. At evening, Carter reached the farthermost pile of embers and camped for the night, tethering his zebra to a sapling, and wrapping himself well in his blankets before going to sleep. And all through the night, a vunith howled distantly from the shore of some hidden pool. But Carter felt no fear of that amphibious terror, since he had been told with certainty that not one of them dares even approach the slope of Ngranik. In the clear sunshine of morning, Carter began the long ascent, taking his zebra as far as that useful beast could go, but tying it to a stunted ash tree when the floor of the thin wood became too steep. Thereafter he scrambled up alone, first through the forest with its ruins of old villages in overgrown clearings, and then over the tough grass where anemic shrubs grew here and there. He regretted coming clear of the trees, since the slope was very precipitous, and the whole thing rather dizzying. At length he began to discern all the countryside spread out beneath him whenever he looked about. The deserted huts of the image-makers, the groves of resin trees and the camps of those who gathered from them, the woods where prismatic magas nest and sing, and even a hint, very far away, of the shores of Yath, and of those forbidding ancient ruins whose name is forgotten. He found it best not to look around, and kept on climbing and climbing, till the shrubs became very sparse, and there was often nothing but the tough grass to cling to. Then the soil became meager, with great patches of bare rock cropping out, and now and then the nest of a condor in a crevice. Finally, there was nothing at all but the bare rock, and had it not been very rough and weathered, he could scarcely have ascended farther. Knobs, ledges, and pinnacles, however, helped greatly, and it was cheering to see occasionally the sign of some lava-gatherer scratched clumsily in the friable stone, and know that wholesome human creatures had been there before him. After a certain height, the presence of man was further shown by handholds and footholds hewn where they were needed, and by little quarries and excavations where some choice vein or stream of lava had been found. In one place, a narrow ledge had been chopped artificially to an especially rich deposit far to the right of the main line of ascent. Once or twice, Carter dared to look around, and was almost stunned by the spread of landscape below. All the island betwixt him and the coast lay open to his sight, with Baharna's stone terraces and the smoke of its chimneys mystical in the distance. And beyond that, the illimitable southern sea with all its curious secrets. Thus far there had been much winding around the mountain, so that the farther and carven side was still hidden. Carter now saw a ledge running upward and to the left, which seemed to head the way he wished, and this course he took in the hope that it might prove continuous. After 10 minutes he saw that it was indeed no cul-de-sac, but that it led steeply on in an arc which would, unless suddenly interrupted or deflected, bring him after a few hours climbing to that unknown southern slope overlooking the desolate crags and the accursed valley of lava. As new country came into view below him, he saw that it was bleaker and wilder than those seaward lands he had traversed. The mountain's side, too, was somewhat different, being here pierced by curious cracks and caves not found on the straighter route he had left. Some of these were above him, and some beneath him, all opening on sheerly perpendicular cliffs and wholly unreachable by the feet of man. The air was very cold now, but so hard was the climbing that he did not mind it. Only the increasing rarity bothered him, and he thought that perhaps it was this which had turned the heads of the other travellers and excited those absurd tales of night-gaunts, whereby they explain the loss of such climbers as fell from these perilous paths. He was not much impressed by travellers' tales, but had a good curved scimitar in case of any trouble. All lesser thoughts were lost in the wish to see that carven face which might set him on the track of the gods atop unknown Karaf. At last, in the fearsome iciness of upper space, he came round fully to the hidden side of Ingranik, and saw, in infinite gulfs below him, the lesser crags and sterile abysses of lava which marked olden wrath of the great ones. There was unfolded, too, a vast expanse of country to the south. But it was a desert land, without fair fields or cottage chimneys, and seemed to have no ending. No trace of the sea was visible on this side, for Oryab is a great island. Black caverns and odd crevices were still numerous on the sheer vertical cliffs, but none of them was accessible to a climber. There now loomed aloft a great beetling mass which hampered the upward view, and Carter was for a moment shaken with doubt lest it prove impassable. Poised in windy insecurity miles above earth, with only space and death on one side, and only slippery walls of rock on the other, he knew for a moment the fear that makes men shun Ngronik's hidden side. He could not turn round, yet the sun was already low. If there were no way aloft, the night would find him crouching there still, and the dawn would not find him at all. But there was a way, and he saw it in due season. Only a very expert dreamer could have used those imperceptible footholds, yet to Carter they were sufficient. Surmounting now the outward hanging rock, he found the slope above much easier than that below, since a great glacier's melting had left a generous space with loam and ledges. To the left, a precipice dropped straight from unknown heights to unknown depths, with a cave's dark mouth just out of reach above him. Elsewhere, however, the mountain slanted back strongly, and even gave him space to lean and rest. He felt from the chill that he must be near the snow line, and looked up to see what glittering pinnacles might be shining in that late ruddy sunlight. Surely enough, there was the snow, uncounted thousands of feet above, and below it a great beetling crag like that he had just climbed, hanging there forever in bold outline. And when he saw that crag, he gasped and cried out aloud and clutched at the jagged rock in awe, for the Titan bulge had not stayed as Earth's dawn had shaped it, but gleamed red and stupendous in the sunset with the carved and polished features of a god. Stern and terrible shone that face that the sunset lit with fire. How vast it was, no mind can ever measure, but Carter knew at once that man never could have fashioned it. It was a god, chiseled by the hands of the gods, and it looked down haughtily and majestic upon the seeker. Rumor had said it was strange and not to be mistaken, and Carter saw that it was indeed so. For those long, narrow eyes and long-lobed ears, and that thin nose and pointed chin, all spoke of a race that is not of men, but of gods. He clung overawed in that lofty and perilous eyrie, even though it was this which he had expected and come to find. For there is, in a god's face, more of marvel than prediction can tell. And when that face is vaster than a great temple, and seen looking downward at sunset in the septic silences of that upper world from whose dark lava it was divinely hewn of old, the marvel is so strong that none may escape it. Here, too, was the added marvel of recognition, for although he had planned to search all dreamland over for those whose likeness to this face might mark them as the gods' children, he now knew that he need not do so. Certainly the great face carven on that mountain was of no strange sort, but the kin of such as he had seen often in the taverns of the seaport Celephaeus, which lays in Uthnargai, beyond the Tanarian hills, and is ruled over by that King Coranes whom Carter once knew in waking life. Every year sailors with such a face came in dark ships from the north to trade their onyx for the carved jade and spun gold and little red singing birds of Celephaeus. And it was clear that these could be no others than the half-gods he sought. Where they dwelt, there must the cold waste lie close, and within it unknown Kadath and its onyx castle for the great ones. So to Celephaeus he must go, far distant from the Isle of Oriab, and in such parts as would take him back to Dylath-Lean and up the sky to the bridge by Nir, and again into the enchanted wood of the Zugs, whence the way would bend northward through the garden lands by Ukranos to the gilded spires of Thran, where he might find a galleon bound over the Serenarian Sea. But dusk was now thick, and the great carven face looked down even sterner in shadow. Perched on that ledge, night found the seeker, and in the blackness he might neither go down nor go up, but only stand and cling and shiver in that narrow place, till the day came, praying to keep awake, lest sleep loose his hold, and send him down the dizzy miles of air to the crags and sharp rocks of the accursed valley. The stars came out, but save for them, there was only black nothingness in his eyes, nothingness leagued with death, against whose beckoning he might do no more than cling to the rocks and lean back away from an unseen brink. The last thing of earth that he saw in the gloaming was a condor soaring close to the westward precipice beside him, and darting screaming away when it came near the cave whose mouth yawned just out of reach. Suddenly, without a warning sound in the dark, Carter felt his curved scimitar drawn stealthily out of his belt by some unseen hand. Then he heard it clatter down over the rocks below. And between him and the Milky Way, he thought he saw a very terrible outline of something noxiously thin and horned and tailed and bat-winged. Other things, too, had begun to blot out patches of stars west of him, as if a flock of vague entities were flapping thickly and silently out of that inaccessible cave in the face of the precipice. Then a sort of cold, rubbery arm seized his neck, and something else seized his feet, and he was lifted inconsiderably up and swung about in space. Another minute, and the stars were gone, and Carter knew that the night gaunts had got him. They bore him breathless into that cliffside cavern, and through monstrous labyrinths beyond. When he struggled, as at first he did, by instinct, they tickled him with deliberation. They made no sound at all themselves, and even their membranous wings were silent. They were frightfully cold and damp and slippery, and their paws kneaded one detestably. Soon they were plunging hideously downward through inconceivable abysses in a whirling, giddying, sickening rush of dank, tomb-like air. And Carter felt they were shooting into the ultimate vortex of shrieking and demonic madness. He screamed again and again, but whenever he did so, the black paws tickled him with greater subtlety. Then he saw a sort of gray phosphorescence about, and guessed they were coming even to that inner world of subterranean horror, of which dim legends tell, and which is litten only by the pale death-fire wherewith reeks the ghoulish air and the primal mists of the pits at Earth's core. At last, far below him, he saw faint lines of gray and ominous pinnacles, which he knew must be the fabled peaks of Throck. Awful and sinister they stand in the haunted disk of sunless and eternal depths, higher than man may reckon, and guarding terrible valleys where the doles crawl and burrow nastily. that Carter preferred to look at them than at his captors, which were indeed shocking and uncouth black things, with smooth, oily, whale-like surfaces, unpleasant horns that curved inward toward each other, bat wings whose beating made no sound, ugly, prehensile paws, and barbed tails that lashed needlessly and disquietingly. And worst of all, they never spoke nor laughed, and never smiled, because they had no faces at all to smile with, but only a suggestive blankness where a face ought to be. All they ever did was clutch and fly and tickle. That was the way of night gaunts. As the band flew lower, the peaks of Throck rose gray and towering on all sides, and one saw clearly that nothing lived on that austere and impressive granite of the endless twilight. At still lower levels, the death fires in the air gave out, and one met only the primal blackness of the void, save aloft, where the thin peaks stood out, goblin-like. Soon, the peaks were very far away, and nothing about but great rushing winds with the dark dankness of neithermost grottos in them. Then, in the end, the night gaunts landed on a floor of unseen things which felt like layers of bones, and left Carter all alone in that black valley. To bring him thither was the duty of the night gaunts that guard N'Granik, and this done, they flapped away silently. When Carter tried to trace their flight, he could not, since even the peaks of Throck had faded out of sight. There was nothing anywhere but blackness and horror and silence and bones. End of part 3.